Chinese school?
Henry shook his head, waving his hand.
Keiko Kabe, yes. We both go to Rainier Elementary, the white school across Yesler Way.
A moment of silence vanished in the car engines that roared by. Henry looked on as the photographer regarded the photo of Keiko.
Then you both must be very special students.
Since when did special become such a burden? A curse, even. There was nothing special about scholarshipping at Rainier. Nothing at all. Then again, he was here looking for someone. Maybe she was special.
Do you know where she lives?
No, I'm sorry. But I see them a lot near the Nippon Kan Hall. There's a park. You might look for her there.
Domo, Henry said.
It was the only Japanese word he knew, aside from what Sheldon had taught him earlier.
You're welcome. Come back, I'll take your picture, the photographer yelled.
Henry was already down the street. Henry and Keiko walked through Kobe Park on their way home from school each day, and he knew the hillside park by the numerous rows of cherry trees that lined the streets. Across from the park sat the Nippon Kan Hall, more of a kabuki theater, really, complete with posters for plays he'd never seen or even heard of, like Osome Hisamatsu and Yuku no Ichiya, written in kanji and English. Like Chinatown, the whole area around the park apparently woke up on Saturdays. Henry followed the crowds, then the music. In front of the Nippon Kan were street performers, dressed in full traditional costumes, fighting with shimmering swords that flexed and bent as they cut the air.
Behind them, musicians played what looked like strange three-string guitars, nothing at all like the yuhu or gaowu, the two-string violins that he was used to hearing when the Peking Opera performed a fighting routine.
With the music and the dancing, Henry forgot all about looking for Keiko, though he occasionally murmured the words Sheldon had taught him.
Oaidekite urishidesu,
mainly out of nervous habit.
Henry!
Even through the music, he knew the voice was hers. He looked around the crowd, lost for a moment, before spotting her sitting on the hillside, the high point of Kobe Park, looking down on the street performers waving. Henry walked up the hill, his palms sweating.
Oaidekite urushidesu. Oaidekite urushidesu.
She put down a small notebook and looked up, smiling.
Henry? What are you doing here?
Oaidekite.
The words rolled off his tongue like a Mack truck. He felt a wisp of perspiration on his forehead.
The words? What was the rest? Urishidesu.
Keiko's face froze in a smile of surprise, interrupted only by her occasional wide-eyed blinking.
What did you just say?
Breathe, Henry. Deep breath. One more time.
Oaidekite urishidesu.
The words came out perfectly. I did it. Silence.
Henry, I don't speak Japanese.
What?
I don't speak Japanese,
Keiko burst out laughing.
They don't even teach it anymore at the Japanese school. They stopped last fall. My mom and dad speak it, but they wanted me to learn only English. About the only Japanese I know is wakadimasen.
Henry sat down beside her, staring at the street performers.
Which means?
Keiko patted his arm.
It means, I don't understand. Understand?
He lay back on the hillside, feeling the cool grass. He could smell the tiny Japanese roses everywhere, dotting the hill with patches of yellow stars.
Whatever it was, Henry, you said it beautifully. What's it mean?
Nothing. It means, what time is it?
Henry glanced at Keiko sheepishly and saw the look of suspicion in her eye.
Did you come all the way over here to ask me what time it was?
Henry shrugged.
A friend just taught it to me. I thought you'd be impressed.
I was wrong.
What kind of notebook is that?
It's a sketchbook. And I am impressed. Just that you'd come all the way over here. Your father would be mad if he knew. Or does he?
Henry shook his head. This was the last place his father would expect to find him. Henry normally hung out at the waterfront on Saturdays, with other boys from the Chinese school, haunting places like Ye Old Curiosity Shop out on Coleman Dock, looking at the real mummies and genuine shrunken heads, daring one another to touch them. But since he'd begun attending Rainier, they all treated him differently. He hadn't changed, but somehow in their eyes, he was different. He wasn't one of them anymore. Like Keiko, he was special.
It's no big deal. I was just in the neighborhood.
Really?
And which neighbor taught you to speak Japanese?
Sheldon, the sax player on South King.
Henry's eyes fell to the sketchbook.
Can I see your drawings?
She handed him her small black sketchbook. Inside were pencil drawings of flowers and plants, and the occasional drawing of a dancer. The last one was a loose sketch of the crowd, the dancers, and a profile of Henry from the host of people below.
It's me. How long did you know I was down there? You just watched me the whole time. Why didn't you say anything?
Keiko pretended that she didn't understand.
Wakadimasen. So sorry, I don't speak English.
Joking, she took her sketchbook back.
See you Monday, Henry.
Bud's Jazz Records, 1986. Henry closed the yearbook in his lap, setting it on the carved cherrywood coffee table next to the framed photograph of him and Ethel on their 30th wedding anniversary. To Henry, her smiling face looked thin, gracefully hiding a certain sadness. In the photo, she was in early remission, but still was missing most of her hair from the radiation treatments. It didn't fall out all at once, like you see in the movies. It came apart in uneven clumps, thick in some places, smooth in others. She'd asked Henry to use a set of clippers and shave it all off, which he did, reluctantly. It was the first of many personal moments they would share together. A long sabbatical into her day-to-day care, part of the mechanics of dying. He'd done all he could. But choosing to lovingly care for her was like steering a plane into a mountain as gently as possible. The crash is imminent. It's how you spend your time on the way down that counts. He thought about moving on, but didn't even know where to begin. So he went where he'd always gone to stimulate his senses, even as a little boy, a place where he always found a little comfort. He grabbed his hat and jacket and found himself stalking the dusty aisles of Bud's Jazz Records. Bud's had been a fixture on South Jackson, near the old Pioneer Square, for as long as Henry could remember. Of course, the original Bud Long didn't actually own the place anymore, but the new guy, a grizzled fellow with sagging hangdog cheeks, like those of a partially deflated Dizzy Gillespie, filled the part amiably. He tended the record counter, where he readily answered to the name Bud.
"Haven't seen you in a while, Henry."
"I've been around," Henry said, flipping through a rack of old 78s, hoping to find something by Oscar Holden, the holy grail of Seattle's jazz recordings. The apocryphal story was that Oscar recorded a Master Session 78 way back in the 30s, on vinyl, not wax. But of the rumored 300 printed, none survived. None that anyone knew about, anyway. But then again, almost no one knew who Oscar Holden was. Seattle greats like Ray Charles and Quincy Jones had moved on to the fame and fortune of Celebrityville. Still, Henry daydreamed that he might find a vinyl copy someday. And now that CDs were starting to outsell records, the used LP bins at Bud's were overflowing with new used records every day. If one still existed, someone was bound to throw it out or trade it in, not knowing what that dusty old recording meant to avid collectors like Henry. After all, Oscar who? Bud turned the music down a bit. You ain't been around here, 'cause I'd have seen you if you were around here. Something modern was playing. Overton Berry, Henry guessed, from the deep melancholy of the piano. Henry thought about his absence. He'd been a regular for most of his adult life, and part of his youth. My turntable was broken, and it had been, so it wasn't a lie. Besides, how do I tell him my wife died 6 months ago? No sense in turning Bud's jazz records into Bud's blues records. You hear about the Panama Hotel? The old dealer asked. Henry nodded, still thumbing through the rack, his nose itchy from the dust that always settled in the basement record shop. I was standing right there when they started bringing all that stuff up. You don't say. Bud rubbed his bald black pate. I know what you're always in here looking for. Oh, I gave up looking for Oscar myself. But it sure makes you wonder, doesn't it? I mean, they board up that whole building, what, around 1950? And then that new owner buys it, goes inspecting, and finds all that stuff sealed up all those years. Newspaper says there ain't much of value in there. No gold bars or nothing. But it makes you wonder. Henry had wondered nonstop, since he'd watched them bring up that first steamer trunk, since the owner had spun that Japanese parasol. Henry fished out an LP by the Seattle jazz drummer Webb Coleman and set it on the counter. I guess this'll do it. Bud slipped the old record in a used Uwajimaya grocery bag and handed it right back. This one's on me, Henry. I'm sorry about your wife. Bud's eyes looked like they'd seen plenty of suffering in his own time. Ethel was a fine woman. I know you did right by her. Henry found a weak smile and thanked him. Some people read the obituaries every day, even in a sprawling place like the Emerald City. But the International District was just a small town. People know everything about everyone. And just as in other small towns, when someone leaves, they never come back. Dim Sum, 1986. When the weekend rolled around, Henry headed past the old Nippon Kan Theater, or what was left of it, his feet crunching bits of broken glass and shattered light bulbs. The colorful marquee that had once lit up the dark streets now was riddled with empty sockets and broken fixtures. The once warm glow, a reflection of how much hope Henry had had as a young boy, sat covered in decades of rust and neglect. Restoration or demolition? Henry didn't know which made more sense. The Nippon Kan had been abandoned decades earlier, like the Panama Hotel. But, like the hotel, it had also been bought in recent years and was in the process of being remodeled. Last he'd heard, the once beating cultural heart of Japantown would soon be a bus station. All these years, he'd never been inside. And even though there had been a small reopening party, 4 decades later, he couldn't bring himself to go. Stopping to soak it in, he watched the construction workers throwing old lavender-upholstered chairs out of a second-story window into the dumpster below. Must be from the balcony, Henry thought. Not much is left. Might be my only time to step past the old ticket window and see that old kabuki theater the way it was. So tempting. But he was almost late to meet Marty at the Sea Fortune restaurant for lunch, and Henry hated to be late. Henry regarded the musty old restaurant as the best in Chinatown. In fact, he'd been coming here for years, going all the way back to his childhood. Although, the first time he came here, it had been a Japanese noodle shop. Since then, it'd been through a merry-go-round of Chinese owners. Smart owners. They always kept the kitchen staff, which kept the food consistent. That was the true key to success in life, Henry thought. Consistency. Marty, on the other hand, wasn't crazy about the dim sum there. Too traditional, he'd argue. Too bland. He much preferred the newer establishments, like House of Hong or Top Gun Seafood. Personally, Henry didn't favor those trendy restaurants that broke with tradition and served dim sum to the yuppie bar crowd until way after midnight. Nor did he care for nouveau Eurasian cuisine
ingredients like smoked salmon or plantains had no place on a dim sum menu, according to Henry's taste buds anyway. As father and son settled into the lumpy, cracked cushions of a bright red Naugahyde booth, Henry flipped open the teapot, sniffing its contents, as though he were sampling some vintage wine. It was old, nothing but brown, tea-stained water with hardly any aroma. He pushed the whole pot lid up to the side and flagged down the ancient serving lady, pushing a cart of steamed dumplings in their general direction. Looking over the sampling of shrimp dumplings, egg tarts, and steamed buns called hombao, Henry pointed and nodded, not even asking what Marty wanted. He knew all of Marty's favorites anyway. "Why do I get the feeling that something new is bothering you?" Marty asked.
"The tea?"
"No, that's just you thinking you're some kind of sommelier of dried leaves in a bag. You've been acting different lately. Something I should know about, Pops?"
Henry unwrapped his cheap wooden chopsticks, rolling them together to rub off any splinters.
"My son is graduating. Soma coma laude."
"Summa cum laude," Marty corrected.
"That's what I said. My son is graduating with highest honor."
Henry popped a steaming hot shrimp shoe mai dumpling into his mouth, chewing as he spoke.
"What could be wrong?"
"Well, Mom's passed, for starters. And now you're pretty much retired. From your job, from taking care of her. I'm just worried about you. What are you doing to pass the time these days?"
Henry offered a pork bao to his son, who took it with his chopsticks and peeled the wax paper off the bottom before taking a large bite.
"I just went back down to Bud's. I picked up a little something. I'm getting out," Henry said.
To punctuate his statement, he held up the bag from the record store. "See? Conclusive evidence that I'm doing just fine." Henry watched his son unwrap a lotus leaf and eat the glutinous sticky rice inside. He could tell by the concern in his son's voice that Marty was unconvinced.
"I'm heading over to the Panama Hotel. I thought I'd ask if they'd let me look around. They found a lot of old things in the basement, things from the war years."
Marty finished chewing. "Looking for some long-lost jazz record, perhaps?" Henry ducked the question, not wanting to lie to his son, who knew he'd been interested in old jazz recordings from a very young age. But that was about all Marty knew of his father's childhood, though he did know that his father had had a hard time of it as a child. Why? He never asked. It somehow seemed sacred, and Henry rarely shared. In return, his son probably thought he was quite boring, a man who had cared for every detail of his wife's last years but had no surprises in him. Mr. Reliable, without a bone of rebellion or spontaneity.
"I'm looking for something," Henry said.
Marty set his chopsticks on the edge of his plate, looking at his father.
"Something I should know about?"
"Who knows, Pops? Maybe I can help." Henry took a bite out of an egg custard tart, set it down, and pushed his plate away.
"If I find something worth sharing, I'll let you know."
"Who knows? I might even surprise you. Wait and see. Wait and see." Marty seemed unconvinced.
"Something bothering you? You're the one who looks like he has something on his mind, aside from studying and grades."
Henry thought his son was about to say something. Then Marty clammed up. Timing seemed to be everything in Henry's family. There had always seemed to be a right time and a wrong time for discussion between Henry and his own father. Maybe his son felt the same.
"He'll deal with it in his own way, and in his own time," Ethel had said, shortly after she learned she had cancer. "He's your son, but he's not a product of your childhood. It doesn't have to be the same."
Ethel had taken Henry out on Green Lake, on a boat, beneath a sunny August sky, to tell him the bad news.
"Oh, I'm not leaving any time soon," she'd said. "But if anything, when I go, I hope my passing brings the two of you together."
She had never stopped mothering her son, and Henry for that matter. Until the treatments began, then everything got turned around, and seemed to stay that way. Now father and son waited in silence, ignoring the carts of dim sum that rolled by. The awkward moment was interrupted by the crash of plates somewhere in the kitchen, punctuated by men swearing at each other in Chinese and English. There was much to say and ask, but neither Henry nor Marty inched closer to the subject. They just waited for their server, who would soon be bringing more tea and orange slices. Henry quietly hummed the tune of an old song. He didn't know the words anymore, but he'd never forgotten the melody. And the more he hummed, the more he felt like smiling again. Marty, on the other hand, just sighed and kept looking for the waitress. Lakeview, 1986. Henry paid the bill and watched as his son waved goodbye, loading an enormous to-go bag into the front seat of his silver Honda Accord. The extra goodies had been at Henry's insistence. He knew his son did okay with the food on campus, but they didn't have anything that compared with a dozen fresh hombao. And besides, steamed pork buns could easily be reheated in the microwave in Marty's dorm room. Content that his son was well on his way, Henry stopped at a flower stand, then stood at the nearest bus stop, where he caught the number 10 to the far side of Capitol Hill, within walking distance of Lakeview Cemetery. When Ethel died, Henry had sworn he'd visit her grave once a week. But it had been 6 months now, and he'd been up to see her only once, on what would have been their 38th wedding anniversary. He placed fresh-cut starfire lilies, the kind they grew in their flower garden, on the small granite headstone that was all that reminded the world that Ethel had once lived. He paid his respects, sweeping away the dried leaves and wiping the moss from her grave, where he placed another small bundle of flowers. Putting his umbrella away and ignoring the fine Seattle mist, he opened his wallet and took out a small white envelope. On the front was the Chinese character for Li, Ethel's last name for the last 37-plus years. Inside had been a piece of hard candy and a quarter. The small envelopes were passed out as he left the Bonnie Watson funeral home, where Ethel's memorial service had been held. The candy was so that everyone leaving would taste sweetness, not bitter. The quarter was for buying more candy on the way home, a traditional token of lasting life and enduring happiness. Henry remembered savoring the candy, a small peppermint, but he didn't feel like stopping at the store on the way home. Marty, ironically, argued that they honor this tradition, but Henry refused. "Take me home," was all he said when Marty slowed down near the Southgate grocery. Henry couldn't bear the thought of spending that quarter. That was all he had left of Ethel. His enduring happiness would have to wait. He'd save it, keeping it with him, always. He thought about that happiness, reaching into the small envelope he carried with him every day, drawing out the quarter. It was unremarkable. A normal coin anyone would spend on a phone call or a cup of bad coffee. But to Henry, it was a promise of something better. Henry remembered the day of Ethel's service. He'd arrived early to meet with Clarence Ma, the funeral director assigned to his family. A kindly man in his 60s, prone to talking about his own bodily ailments, Clarence was the patron saint of all things funerary when it came to Chinatown. Each neighborhood had its own advocate. The stately walls of the Bonnie Watson funeral home were covered with their framed photos, a United Nations of ethnically diverse funeral directors.
"Henry, you're early.
Something I can do for you?"
Clarence said, looking up from his desk, where he'd been stuffing the coins and candy into envelopes as Henry walked by.
"Just wanted to check the flowers," Henry replied, heading into the chapel where a large portrait of Ethel sat surrounded by flower arrangements of various sizes.
Clarence caught up to him, placing his arm on his shoulder.
"Beautiful, isn't it?"
Henry nodded. We made sure to place your flowers right next to her picture. She was a lovely woman, Henry. I'm sure she's in a happier place, but hardly one as beautiful. Clarence handed Henry a small white envelope. In case you don't remember after the service, take it, just in case. Henry felt the quarter inside. He held the envelope to his nose and could smell the peppermint among the wet, fragrant scents of the floral-filled room. Thank you, was all he could muster. Now, standing in the misty rain of Lakeview Cemetery, Henry touched the envelope to his nose again. He couldn't smell a thing. I'm sorry I haven't been here as often as I should have, he apologized. He held the quarter in his hand, putting the envelope in his pocket. He listened to the sound of the wind blowing through the trees, never really expecting an answer, but always open to the possibility. I have some things I need to do. And, well, I just wanted to come by and tell you first. But you probably know all this. Henry's attention drifted to the marker next to Ethel's. It was his parents. Then he looked back to where Ethel lay. You always knew me so well. Henry brushed the graying hair from his temples, wet from the drizzly rain. I'm getting by. But I'm worried about Marty. I've always worried about him. I guess I'd ask that you look out for him. Me, I can look out for myself. I'll be okay. Henry looked around to see if anyone might be watching him having this odd one-way conversation. He was all alone. He wasn't even sure if Ethel was listening. It was one thing to talk to her at home, where she'd lived. But out here, in the cold ground next to his parents, she was certainly gone. Still, Henry had needed to come out to say goodbye. He kissed the quarter and placed it on top of Ethel's headstone. This was our promise of happiness, Henry thought. It's all I have left to give. This is so you can be happy without me. He stood back, hands at his sides, and took three deep bows out of respect. I have to go now, Henry said. Before he left, he drew a lily from Ethel's bundle of flowers and set it on his mother's grave. He even brushed a few leaves from his father's stone before opening his umbrella and walking back down the hill in the direction of Volunteer Park. He took the long way back, down a winding path that led to the near-empty parking lot. Lakeview Cemetery was a beautiful place, despite the somber graves that stood as cold reminders of so much loss and longing. The final resting place of Chief Seattle's daughter, and other notables like Asa Mercer and Henry Yesler, it was a walking tour of Seattle's forgotten history. Not unlike the Nisei War Memorial Monument in the northeast corner. It was a smaller monument, smaller than the headstones of members of the Nordstrom family, dedicated to Japanese-American veterans, locals who died fighting the Germans. These days, it went all but unnoticed, except by Henry, who tipped his hat as he slowly walked by. Speak Your American, 1942. Henry stood in front of the mirror, examining his school clothes. He'd asked his mother to iron them, but they still looked wrinkled. He tried on an old Seattle Indians baseball cap, then thought better of it, combing his hair yet again. Anxiety about Monday mornings was nothing new. In fact, it normally began on Sunday afternoons. Even though he was used to his routine at Rainier Elementary, his stomach would knot up as the hours passed, each minute bringing him closer to his return to the all-white school, the bullies, the heckling, and his lunch duties in the cafeteria with Mrs. Beatty. This Monday morning, though, his ritual of serving the other kids seemed downright exciting. Those 40 precious minutes in the kitchen had become time well spent, since he'd get to see Keiko. Silver lining? Indeed. "You want big smile this morning, Henry," his father commented in Chinese, slurping his juk, thick rice soup, mixed with dice-preserved cabbage. Not a favorite of Henry's, but he ate it politely. Henry took slices of preserved duck egg out of his own bowl and set them in his mother's before she returned from the kitchen. He liked the salty slices, but knew they were her favorite, and she never saved much for herself anyway. On their dark cherry wood table sat a lazy Susan used for serving. He spun it back to its original position just as his mother was returning, her bowl back in front of her. His father's eyes peeked over his newspaper. The front page headline read, British Evacuate Rangoon.
You liking your school now? Huh?
His father spoke as he turned the page. Henry, knowing not to speak Cantonese at home, answered with a nod.
They fixed the stairs, huh? The ones you fell down?
Again, Henry nodded, acknowledging his father's Cantonese, and kept eating his thick breakfast soup. He listened to his father during these lopsided one-way conversations, but he never talked back. In fact, Henry rarely talked at all, except in English to acknowledge his advancing skills. But since his father understood only Cantonese and a little Mandarin, the conversations came as waves, back and forth, tidal shores of separate oceans. The truth was that Henry had been beaten up by Chaz Preston on that first day of school, but his parents wanted him there so much that not being appreciative would have been a terrible insult. So Henry made up some excuse, speaking his American. Of course, his parents didn't understand, imploring him to be more careful next time. Henry did his best to honor and respect his parents. He walked to school each day, going upstream against a sea of Chinese kids who called him White Devil. He worked in the school kitchen as White Devils called him Yellow. But that was okay. I'll do what I have to, Henry thought. But along the way, I think I'm tired of being careful. Finishing his breakfast, he thanked his mother and gathered his books for school. Each had a newly wrapped cover, made from folded jazz club flyers. After school that Wednesday, Henry and Keiko did their work duties. Emptied the trash in the classrooms, pounded erasers. Then they waited for the danger to subside. Chaz and Denny Brown were responsible for retiring the flag each day, which kept them around a little longer than usual. But it had been 30 minutes since the final bell, and they were nowhere to be seen. Henry gave the all-clear to Keiko, who hid in the girls' restroom while Henry scouted the parking lot. Except for the normal janitorial crew, he and Keiko were typically the last to leave, and today was no different. They walked side by side, down the stairs, and past the naked flagpole, dangling their book bags beside them. Henry noticed Keiko's sketchbook, the one she'd had in the park, in her book bag.
"Who taught you how to draw?" he asked.
And draw so well, Henry thought, with just a hint of jealousy, secretly admiring her talent. Keiko shrugged.
"My mother, I suppose. Mainly. She was an artist when she was about my age. She dreamed of going to New York City and working in a gallery. But she has pain in her hands now and doesn't draw or paint as much, so she gave her art supplies to me. She wants me to go to college at the Cornish Institute on Capitol Hill. That's an art school, you know."
Henry had heard of Cornish, a 4-year academy for fine artists, musicians, and dancers. It was a fancy place, a prestigious place. He was impressed. He'd never known a real artist, except for maybe Sheldon. Still,
"They won't take you."
Keiko stopped in her tracks, turning to Henry.
"Why not? Because I'm a girl?"
Sometimes Henry's mouth was too big for his face. He didn't know a delicate way around the subject, so he just said what he was thinking.
"They won't take you, 'cause you're Japanese." "That's why my mom wants me to apply there. To be the first."
Keiko kept walking, leaving Henry a few steps behind.
"Speaking of my mother, I asked her what 'oidekte ureshi desu' means," Keiko said.
Henry walked a step behind, looking around nervously. He noticed Keiko's flowered dress. For someone who appeared so sweet, she sure seemed to know how to needle him. "It was Sheldon's dumb idea," he said.
"It was a nice thing to say."
Keiko paused, as if looking at a group of seagulls sweeping by overhead, then looked back at Henry, who caught a glint of mischief in her eyes.
"Thank you. And Sheldon," she smiled and continued walking.
As they approached Sheldon's usual corner, there was no music, no crowd, and no sign of the sax player anywhere. He normally played across from the Rainier Heat and Power Building, its entrance still covered in sandbags from bombing jitters earlier in the year. Tourists walked by as though he'd never existed. Henry and Keiko looked at each other, wondering.
"He was here this morning," Henry said. "He mentioned that his tryout at the Black Elks Club went well. Maybe he got called back."
"Maybe he'd landed a regular gig with Oscar Holden, who Sheldon said had regular practice jams on Monday and Wednesday nights. They were free, so a lot of people popped in and played or just enjoyed the music." Henry stood on the corner, looking up at neon signs marking the jazz clubs that lined both sides of Jackson Street.
"How late do your parents let you play outside?"
he asked, looking at the horizon, trying to find the sun hidden somewhere behind the dense, overcast haze of Seattle's waterfront.
"I don't know. I usually take my sketchbook. So until it gets dark, I guess."
Henry looked up at the Black Elks Club, wondering what time Sheldon might be playing.
"Mine too. My mother does the dishes and then relaxes, and my father settles in with the newspaper and listens to the news on the radio."
That left Henry with a few hours. Still, evenings could be a dangerous time to be walking the streets. Since so many drivers had painted their headlights blue or covered them with cellophane to comply with blackout restrictions, accidents, either head-on collisions or people simply being run over crossing the street at night, were on the rise. Seattle's thick fog, which slowed down traffic on the streets and made trouble for the ships sailing in and out of Elliott Bay, had become a blanket of comfort, hiding homes and buildings from phantom Japanese bombers or artillery from suspected Japanese submarines. It seemed like there was danger everywhere, from drunken sailors behind the wheel, Japanese saboteurs, and worst of all, his own parents, if they caught him.
"I want to go," Keiko insisted.
She looked at Henry, then up the street toward the row of jazz clubs. She brushed the hair out of her eyes, looking like she'd already made up her mind about a question he hadn't even asked.
"You don't even know what I'm thinking. If you're going to go listen to him play, I'm coming with you."
Henry thought about it. He'd already bent the rules by spending time in Nihonmachi. So why not head up Jackson and see the sights? Maybe even hear the songs. It would be okay, as long as they weren't seen, and as long as they made it home before dark.
"We're not going anywhere together. My dad will kill me. But if you want to meet me in front of the Black Elks Club at 6 o'clock, after dinner, I'll be there."
"Don't be late," Keiko replied.
He walked with her through Nihonmachi, the route they always took. Henry had no clue how they'd actually get into the Black Elks Club. One, they weren't black. Even if he replaced the button he wore with one that said, "I am Negro," that wasn't going to cut it. And two, they probably weren't old enough. Although he thought he'd seen entire families, young kids in tow, go inside. But that was only on certain nights, like bingo night at the Bing Kong Benevolent Association. All he knew was that he'd figure it out. They would listen from the street if they had to. It was only a few blocks over, a little farther for Keiko, but not too far. Close to home, but a world away. From his parents' world, anyway.
"Why do you like jazz so much?" Keiko asked.
"I don't know," Henry said, and he didn't really. "Maybe because it's so different. But people everywhere still like it. They just accept musicians, no matter what color they are. Plus, my father hates it.
Why does he hate it?
Because it's too different, I guess.
As they reached Keiko's apartment building, Henry waved goodbye and turned toward home. Walking away, he watched Keiko's reflection in the side mirror of a parked car. She looked over her shoulder and smiled. Caught peeking, he turned his head and cut through the vacant lot behind Nichibei Publishing and past the Naruto-yu, a Japanese sento, bathhouse. Henry couldn't picture bathing with his parents the way some Japanese families did. He couldn't picture himself doing a lot of things with his parents. He wondered about Keiko's own family, and what they might think of her sneaking out to a jazz club, let alone to meet Henry. He felt his stomach turn a little. His heart raced when he thought about Keiko, but his gut tightened just the same. In the distance, he heard the faint sound of jazz musicians warming up. Jamaican Ginger, 1942. When Keiko arrived outside the Black Elks Club, Henry immediately felt underdressed. Basically, he wore the same clothes he'd had on earlier in the day, the I Am Chinese button still pinned to his school shirt. Keiko, though, had dressed for the occasion, and had on a bright pink dress and shiny brown leather shoes. Her hair, which had been pulled back and bobbed with pins and hot rollers, now hung in swoopy curls to her shoulders. She wrapped herself in a white sweater she said her mother had knitted. Her sketchbook was tucked neatly beneath her arm. Dumbfounded, Henry said the first thing that came to his mind.
"You look beautiful,"
he said it in English, watching Keiko beam, astonished at how different she looked, only vaguely resembling the silly apron-wearing girl from the school kitchen.
"No Japanese? No oidekte urushi desu?"
she teased.
"I'm speechless."
Keiko returned his smile.
"Do we just go in?"
"We can't." Henry shook his head and pointed to a sign that read, "No minors allowed after 6 p.m.
"They're serving booze. We're too young. But I've got an idea. Follow me."
He pointed to the alley, where he and Keiko looped around, finding the back door. It was framed with thick glass blocks, but music emanated from the screen door, which was slightly ajar.
"Are we sneaking in?"
Keiko asked, concerned. Henry shook his head.
"They're bound to see us and toss us."
Instead, he scrounged up a pair of wooden milk crates, and they both sat down, listening to the music, ignoring the pungent smells of beer and mold in the alley. "I can't believe I'm here," Henry thought. The sun was still out, and the music was brisk and lively. After the first 15 minutes set, the screen door creaked open, and an old black man stepped out to light a cigarette. Startled, Henry and Keiko jumped up to run. They were sure they would be shooed away for loitering.
"What are you kids doing hanging out back here? Trying to scare the bejesus out of this old man?"
He patted his chest above his heart, then sat down where Henry had been sitting. The rumpled old man wore long trousers, held up by gray suspenders, over a wrinkled button-down shirt, the sleeves rolled up. To Henry, he looked like an unmade bed.
"Sorry,"
Keiko offered, flattening out the wrinkles in her dress.
"We were just listening to the music. We were just about to leave."
Henry interrupted.
"Is Sheldon playing with the band tonight?"
"Sheldon who? We got a lot of new faces in there tonight, son."
"He plays the saxophone."
The old man wiped his sweaty hands on his pants and lit his smoke. Hacking and coughing, he puffed away as if it were a competition, and he was the losing team, working toward a comeback. Henry listened as the old man caught his breath between draws.
"He's in there, doing a fine job. You a fan of his or something?"
"I'm just a friend, and I wanted to come down and hear Oscar Holden. I'm a fan of Oscar's."
"Me too,"
Keiko added, getting swept up in the moment, crowding close to Henry. The old man stubbed his cigarette out on the worn heel of his shoe, then tossed the butt into the nearest garbage can.
You're a fan of Oscar's, huh? He pointed at Henry's button. Oscar got an old Chinese fan club these days?
Henry covered the button with his coat.
This is just my father's.
It's okay, kid. Some days I wish I was Chinese, too.
The old man laughed a gravelly smoker's laugh that trailed into a cough, wheezing and spitting on the ground.
Well, if you're fans of Sheldon the Sax Man, and fans of Oscar the Piano Man, I figure Oscar probably wouldn't mind having a couple little kids from the fan club in his house tonight. Now, you won't tell no one about this, will you?
Henry looked at Keiko, unsure if the old man was kidding or not. She just kept smiling. Her eager grin was larger than his. Both shook their heads no.
We won't tell a soul, Keiko promised.
Great. I need you two fan club kids do me a little favor if you want admittance to the club tonight.
Henry deflated a bit as he watched the old man take some slips of paper out of his shirt pocket, handing one to each of them. He compared his note with Keiko's. They were almost identical. Some sort of scribbled writing and a signature from a doctor.
Now you take these to the pharmacy on Weller. You tell them it's on our account. You bring it back, and you get in.
I don't think I understand, Henry said. This is medicine?
It's a prescription for Jamaican ginger, a secret ingredient around here. This is how the world works, son. With the war, everything's being rationed. Sugar, gasoline, tires, booze. Plus, they don't let us have a liquor license in the colored clubs, so we do what they did a few years back. During the Prohibition. We make it and shake it, baby.
The old black man pointed to a neon sign of a martini tumbler that hung above the doorway.
For medicinal purposes, you all know. Go on now.
Henry looked at Keiko, not sure what to do or what to believe. It didn't seem like that big a request. He must have gone to the drugstore 100 times for his mother. Besides, Henry loved to snack on dried ginger. Maybe this was something like that.
We'll be right back.
Keiko tugged at Henry's coat, leading him back out the alley and around to Jackson Street. Weller was one block over.
Does this make us bootleggers?
Henry asked, when he saw the rows of bottles through the drugstore window. He was both nervous and excited at the prospect. He'd listened to This Is Your FBI on the radio as G-men busted up smuggling rings coming down from Canada. You rooted for the good guys, but when you played cops and robbers outside the next day, you always wanted to be the bad guy.
I don't think so. It's not illegal anymore. Besides, we're just running errands. Like you said, they sell it, but they can't buy it from the white places, so they make it.
Henry gave up any concern about wrongdoing and headed into the Owl drugstore, which conveniently stayed open until 8. Bootleggers don't go to pharmacies, he told himself. You can't go to jail for picking up an order, can you? If the skinny old druggist thought it was odd for two little Asian kids each to be picking up a bottle that was 80% alcohol, he didn't say a word. Truth be told, by the way he squinted at the prescriptions and labels, with an enormous handheld magnifying glass, he probably didn't even see much of anything. But the clerk, a young black man, just winked and flashed them a knowing smile as he slipped their bottles into separate bags. No charge, he said. On their way out, Henry and Keiko didn't even pause to moon over the jars of penny candy. Instead, they looked at each other in mock nonchalance, each feeling a little bit older, striding across the street, with 10-ounce bottles of liquor swinging at their sides. Small victors in a grown-up scavenger hunt.
What do they do with this stuff?
Drink it? Henry asked, looking at his bottle.
My papa told me how people used to use it to make bathtub gin.
Henry pictured the sailors who were known to stagger down the street and cause fights late at night, stumbling around like their legs belonged to someone else. Jake-legged, people called it, from bad gin.
Sailors and soldiers from Payne Army Airfield were banned from certain uptown clubs for fighting. So they wandered into the jazz alleys of South Jackson, or even into Chinatown on occasion, looking for a bar that would serve them. Henry couldn't believe people still drank this stuff. But when he saw the crowds that gathered outside the Black Elks Club, he knew they were here for the same thing he was. They were here to partake of something lush, intoxicating, and almost forbidden. They were here for the music. And tonight, at the front of the building, where latecomers lined up to get in, some were even being turned away. A huge crowd for a weeknight. Oscar sure packed them in. In the alley behind the club, Henry could hear musicians tuning up for their next set. He thought he heard Sheldon tweaking his saxophone. On the back step, a younger man dressed in a white apron and black bow tie was waiting for them. He opened the screen door and rushed them through a makeshift service kitchen, where they put their bottles of Jamaican ginger in a tub of ice with other odd-shaped bottles of mysterious properties. Out in the main room, near a worn wooden dance floor, their escort pointed at some chairs beside the kitchen door, next to where a busboy was folding a pile of cloth napkins into perfect little white triangles. "You sit over there and stay out of trouble. I'll go see if Oscar is ready," he told them. Henry and Keiko gazed in awe through the dark, smoky lounge, speckled with tall glasses on burgundy tablecloths, and jewelry that sparkled on the patrons huddled around the small, candlelit tables. The chatter dimmed as an old man found his way to the bar, where he poured himself a tall glass of ice water, wiping the sweat from his brow. It was the old man from behind the club, the one who'd been smoking in the alley. Henry's jaw dropped as the old man headed on stage, flexed his wrists, and popped his knuckles before sitting down at the upright piano in front of a large jazz ensemble. Sheldon was perched behind a bandbox with the rest of the horn section. The old man shucked his suspenders from his shoulders, giving his upper body room to roam, and slid his fingers across the keyboard as the rest of the band fell into rhythm. To Henry, the crowd appeared to be holding their breath. The old man at the piano spoke as he started playing an intro. "This is for my two new friends. It's called Alley Cats. It's a little different, but I think you're gonna like it." Henry had listened to Woody Herman and Count Basie once or twice on the radio, but to hear a 12-piece orchestra live was unlike anything he'd ever experienced. Most of the music he heard vicariously spilling out of the clubs up and down South Jackson was of the small ensemble variety, with simple broken beats, a few musicians playing freestyle. This was a speeding freight train by comparison. The double bass and drums drove the tune while magically cutting away all at once to allow Oscar to take the spotlight with his featured piano solos. Henry turned to Keiko, who had opened up her sketchbook and was doing her best to pencil in the scene. "It's swing jazz," she said. "This is what my parents listen to. My mom says they don't play it like this at the white clubs. It's too crazy for some people." When Keiko mentioned her parents, Henry began noticing the makeup of the crowd. Nearly all were black, some sitting and swaying, while others strutted on the floor, dancing spontaneously to the frenetic pace of the band. Standing out in the crowd were several Japanese couples, drinking and soaking in the music, like flowers turned toward the sun. Henry looked for Chinese faces. There were none. Keiko pointed to one of the small tables where three Japanese couples sat, sipping their drinks and laughing. "That's Mr. Toyama. He was my English composition teacher at the Japanese school for one quarter. That must be his wife. I think the other two are teachers as well." Henry watched the Japanese couples and thought about his own parents. His mother, busy with her housework, or community service at the Bing Kong Benevolent Association, where she'd trade in her gasoline coupons for ration stamps, red stamps for meat, lard, and oil, and blue stamps for beans, rice, and canned goods. his father, with his ear tuned to the radio, listening for the latest news about the war in Russia, the war in the Pacific, the war in China, spending his day leading fundraising drives to support the Kuomintang, the nationalist army fighting the Japanese in the northern provinces of China. He was even ready to fight the war here, having volunteered as a block warden for the Chinatown area. He was one of the few civilians issued a gas mask as a precaution against the impending Japanese invasion. The war affected everyone, even here at the Black Elks Club. The blackout curtains were drawn, making the mood feel secretive to Henry, like a place hidden from the troubles of the world. Maybe that was why they all came here, to escape, running away with a martini made from Jamaican ginger, chasing it with Oscar Holden's rendition of "I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good." Henry could have stayed all night, Keiko too, probably. But when he peeked behind the heavy curtain, the sun was setting over Puget Sound and the Olympic Mountains in the distance. He looked out the window as teenagers, older than he and Keiko, ran up and down the sidewalk shouting, "Put out your lights! Put out your lights!" Inside, Oscar took another break. "It's almost dark. Time to go," Henry said. Keiko looked at Henry like he'd woken her from a wonderful dream. They waved at Sheldon, who finally saw them and waved back, looking happy and surprised to see them. He met them by the kitchen door.
"Henry, and this must be..."
Sheldon looked at him with eyes wide. Henry saw the expression. He looked more impressed than surprised.
"This is Keiko. She's my friend from school. She's on scholarship, too."
Keiko shook Sheldon's hand.
"Nice to meet you. It was Henry's idea. We hung out back and then..."
"And then Oscar put you to work. That's how it happened, isn't it? He's like that, always looking out for his club, looking out for his band. What'd you think?"
"The best. He should put out a record," Keiko gushed.
"Now, now. We gotta walk before we can run. Bills to pay, you know? Okay, we're about to light it up again for the 8 o'clock session, so you two better run along now. It's almost dark. And I don't know about you, miss, but I know Henry can't be out that late. Little man ain't got no brother, so I'm his big brother. Gotta look out for him. In fact, we look alike, don't we?"
Sheldon put his face next to Henry's.
"That's the only reason he wears that button, so they don't confuse the two of us."
Keiko smiled and laughed. She touched Sheldon's cheek with the palm of her hand, her eyes lighting up as they met Henry's.
"How long are you playing here?" Henry asked.
"Just through the weekend. Then Oscar said we'd talk."
"Knock 'em dead,"
Henry said, as he and Keiko headed through the swinging kitchen door. Sheldon smiled and held up his sacks.
"Thank you, sir. You have a fine day now."
Henry and Keiko threaded their way through the kitchen, between a large butcher block on wheels and racks of dishes, glasses, and silverware. A few of the kitchen staff looked puzzled as the two of them smiled and walked on by, heading for the back landing in the alley. The evening had been incredible. Henry wished he could tell his parents about it. Maybe he would, at breakfast tomorrow. In English. The door leading to the alley had been closed and locked. It was almost blackout time. When Henry opened the heavy wooden sway, lurching in the doorway were two white faces in plain black suits that blotted out what little light remained in the dusky twilight. Henry stopped breathing, frozen, as he heard for the first time the cold metal tumble of a revolver being cocked. Each man gripped a fistful of gunmetal, short, piercing barrels pointed directly at his smallish 12-year-old frame, as he broke his paralysis to step in front of Keiko, shielding her the best he could. On their suit coats hung badges. They were federal agents. Music inside the Black Elks Club clattered to a halt. The only sounds Henry heard were his own racing heartbeat and men everywhere shouting, "FBI!" Henry knew it. They were being busted up for bootlegging, for hauling bottles of Jamaican ginger to some speakeasy where they'd get fingered for making bathtub gin. but as shocked as he was, stunned was more like it, Keiko looked terrified. Henry felt the heavy hand.